I'm Alejandra Melian.
I'm Daniel Chu Castillo.
And I'm Riley Bertoncini. Welcome to Talking Culture.
Before we begin, we'd like to acknowledge that this podcast is produced on the traditional and unceded territory of the Kanien'kehá:ka on the land known as Tsuut'ŭaagi. We recognize the Kanien'kehá:ka as the rightful stewards of this land.
Hello, how's everyone doing?
Hello, Danielle. Hello, Riley. Pretty good. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Not enjoying the cold. Well, I mean, it's nice, but it's still winter and it gets dark at 4, which is ridiculous.
That is always what gets me. The cold isn't the worst part. It's the lack of light.
Does it get dark at 5 for you too, Alejandra?
No, it's not. It gets dark around 6 right now. So it's still, you know, like, not great. It's just that it used to get dark at 10.
Fair enough.
But no complaints. Like, it gets dark, but I'm still, you know, in a t-shirt working with my windows open, you know, so there's not, I can't complain too much.
Well, you're probably gonna miss Montreal soon.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. All the pictures that I'm seeing of the snow and people trudging through the snow is making me really miss home.
Yeah, exactly.
No. but Danielle, you are dealing with COVID right now. Are you okay?
Yeah, it's the first time that I get it. Somehow I had managed to escape it for the last almost 3 years. But no, I finally got to me and I had my week of feverish dreams and a headache. Yeah. That's not what I expected, but yeah. Apparently there is such a thing as COVID headaches that don't get solved magically with Tylenol. So that was the sad bit for me. Mm. No TV for me, unfortunately.
Oh, I'm really sorry. You're feeling better now, though?
Yeah, it's great. I feel better now. And how about you, Riley? How do you think?
Pretty good, yeah. I also feel unwell, but I think that's just because I'm trying to be active in summery, and it's actually winter, and I want to hibernate, and so I just need to accept that and stop holding myself to a standard that the weather does not match.
No, totally. Yeah, we have to, like, allow our bodies to adapt to the environment and not expect too much of ourselves in the wintertime.
And you, Alejandra, how's the writing going?
Yeah, right now it's actually going really well. I am almost done outlining all of my chapters and for the dissertation. And I'm really, really excited about how much data I collected during my fieldwork. I, like, really have a lot to work with, and I'm feeling really inspired. Just feeling really inspired to get it all down on the page. So, like, knock on wood, you never know when this feeling is going to go away. But for now, it's I feel really connected to my project currently, and really excited about it. So it's good.
That's great. You should run with it as long as you can. I hear that lots of inspirations are sometimes hard to come by.
Exactly, I know. Just, how do I keep this alive? How do I keep my conditions exactly the way that they are right now? Not change anything. I'm really excited to talk about this episode today, Danielle. Do you wanna tell us a little bit about what you decided to record for us?
Yes. So I'm very, very excited about this episode. I had been thinking about it since last season, but it finally happened this time. So in today's episode, I wanted to explore the idea of queer anthropology. And in a somewhat caricaturist representation of opinions that I have heard here and there, a minority of people within academia seem to be of the opinion that is kind of a trend, you know, like kind of a fad. Admittedly, like what I same dryness, more of a strum, and I don't want to like point fingers or anything like that. But it still made me curious about the real struggles that people face when pursuing this line of research. Like, I don't think I've had a course that was specifically intended in that direction at McGill. And definitely not from the perspective of queer anthropologists as well, right? So it also makes me question, what does it mean to queer anthropology? How does this alter our research questions and methods? And how does it impact our teaching?
Yeah, I mean, that, like, there is so much to think about there because, you know, like, it is, I mean, this is an issue in anthropology in general, but that separation between the anthropologists and the people that they are studying is often, like, a really interesting, complex line. And I feel like, you know, there's a lot to think about in terms of queerness in anthropology being a topic, but then also a point of view. Because, you know, I don't know, this may not always be true, but I imagine that most of the anthropologists that engage in queer anthropology would consider themselves queer as well. And so there's something really interesting to me about, like, the reflexivity involved in that and, like, the personal point of view that you bring into that study, you know?
For me, I mean, it's interesting because it's related, but I guess a different tangent. The thing that I think of, I mean, as a gay man, is that in anthropology, sometimes I think we're almost too reflexive, so reflexive that we kind of get paralyzed and we don't say or do, especially do anything of any sort of meaning in the world because we're afraid to take a stance. And my experiences growing up sort of in a small town and trying to come to grips with, you know, being a gay man has been that actually oftentimes it's more powerful to sort of, you know, as long as you're not sort of harming anyone, making a choice and then refusing the explanation or sort of the analysis. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and sometimes when we think of queer anthropology, it's not just about sort of entering things into this sort of, you know, matrix of gender and sexuality and all this stuff. It can also be making decisions about our needs, our desires, our points of view, and refusing to explain or rationalize those decisions because they're, you know, they're good for us. So if someone says, you know, why do you want to do fieldwork there? Because I want to. And there's, mm-hmm. to an extent, that doesn't need to be explained. And I think that's what's really, really powerful when we think about this. And it's something that, you know, is also talked about in indigenous sort of anthropology, but it's actually the sort of, the ownership of oneself and one's needs. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you bring up a really good point about, like, not needing to justify what it is that you're doing as, in this case, a queer person engaging in anthropology. And I also wonder, like, I also am a queer woman. And, you know, at what point does just being a queer anthropologist kind of make any anthropology that you're doing queer? You know, like, it will always be coming from the point of view of a person who experiences queerness and experiences the world through some sort of queer identity. And so, you know, I don't want to say that, like, the work that I do is queer anthropology, but I do think that that's an interesting line, you know, an interesting way of thinking about, like, the anthropologists and the effect that they have just in, like, the theory that they're using or the way it is that they're thinking about a topic.
It really brings up two things for me. One is this idea that sort of being queer, indigenous, or of color forces you to do a certain kind of anthropology. This was a question brought up in the hiring recently of a indigenous anthropologist. And there was some people sort of saying, oh, well, they should study indigenous things. Well, you know, what are we doing sort of in the academy if we're telling indigenous people what they have to study? Like, is that beneficial? Yeah. I mean, what even is that? And the second one is that, I mean, much, much sort of lighter and funnier, but when I was little, I liked playing the violin, and I did not like Métis music, even though I come from a Métis background. I really liked Bach and Beethoven. And I said to my uncle, people tell me I'm sort of like not a good Métis because I'm not playing the Red River Jig constantly. And he said, no, but you are, so anything you play is Métis, you know? Yeah. So it's Métis, yeah. Bach. Yeah. And that's quite, I think, quite a more affirming and sort of freeing. It makes us agents in our own lives, and I think there's something very powerful about that.
Yeah, and it also, like, brings, you know, whatever identity we're talking about, whether that be indigeneity or queerness, I'll speak from a point of queerness, it also, like, I don't want to say normalizes, but, like, brings queerness into the rest of the world, right? And, like, allows queerness to be in every space. And, like, that, you know, you just... from coming from a specific identity doesn't mean you have to be 100% focused on that all the time, and that just your existence, and in our case, like an academic interest in the rest of the world, brings queerness into those spaces of the world. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I've often thought that, you know, success for sort of, at least when I was sort of younger, and sort of being gay, and I would look and I would see sort of all these theories about gayness, and it felt so far away from me. And then I read this trashy romance novel, and I thought, yeah, okay, now there's some success, because it's gotten, if whatever the thing is in a trashy Harlequin romance, it's probably somehow like found its way into the broader culture. It's a good it's a good test.
Well, I'm very excited to hear what you guys just said, because it really resonates with the conversation that I had with Marielle. She does bring two points that I guess, I don't want to spoil it too much, but like maybe to keep it up in your minds when you listen to this, is the question of politics, that the stance of doing a queer anthropology is inherently political. And that's why I wanted to think about the question of not only queer anthropology, but queering anthropology. But I'm really excited for you guys to hear this podcast. So Riley, would you mind introducing Marielle, please?
Sure. Marielle is a PhD candidate in sociocultural anthropology at l'Université de Montréal. Her research work done within the LGBTQ+ community of Montréal focuses on silence, cultural intimacy, and the use of non-definition as a way to reinvent norms. She also teaches urban anthropology as well as queer and feminist anthropology, two research paradigms she engages with in her work to question the way we practice anthropology today.
Awesome. Well, I am so excited that we're talking about this week. And so without further ado, let's give it a listen.
Hi, we are talking today to Marielle. Marielle, would you like to introduce yourself? Like, give us a rundown of who you are, what are your interests?
Yeah, sure. Hi, Dan. Thank you for having me. I am from France originally, but I've been in Canada and Montreal for years, and I study at the Université de Montréal, so UDM. I study anthropology. I'm finishing my PhD right now in my fifth year. I work with the queer community in Montreal, and I'm interested in ideas of non-definition and silence and everything that would help create another kind of knowledge against norms. And I also teach urban anthropology and feminist anthropology, queer and feminist anthropology, which is a course I co-created with Catherine Cook at the UDM.
Nice. So as I explained to you a little bit earlier, and as our listeners know, our theme of this season is practice. And as you know, we're going to take this broader, more general approach to the idea of practice. We are interested not only in how we practice anthropology in the field and how that affects our research questions, but also how it affects our teaching, like how are we explaining these ideas. So if you want to tackle it from the research, how does queer anthropology look like for you at the very beginning of just conceiving the idea of what research will be?
Well, I'll base my answer from my experience, because in theory I don't have a fixed answer, but I changed my subject of research halfway through my PhD. I did my doctoral exam on something else entirely. And then I realized I needed to work on something that concerned me, I needed to work on something that was also about me, that was close to my heart, that I felt accountable to, in a way, to people that I'm close to help produce this knowledge, the knowledge about us. So I belong to the queer community as well. And I didn't feel that in academia there was enough about us from us. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to change that. I wanted to work on something that mattered to me. So I think, to me, at the stage of conceiving a project, queer anthropology is inherently political. Because you're going to go against the whole academia and how it's structured. And it's not structured for queer anthropology. So if you engage in this, and feminist anthropology as well, or postcolonial anthropology, decolonial anthropology, sorry, you're going to have to go against the status quo. So if it has to be political, it is political.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Or how else would you say you've experienced, like, maybe a lack of perceived importance or maybe legitimacy around the research that you're doing?
Funding, for one. Like, there is no way right now that at the Université de Montréal anyway, that I'm just speaking about this university because that's the only one I know, but there's no funding for this in anthropology. There's funding for queer studies, actually very few, but if there is any, it's within sociology and psychology in literature. Even like psychology and literature are the two that get funded. I did some research on that. In the last 5 years, the FRQSC, the Quebec Research Fund for Human Sciences, 8% roughly of the funded projects were about gender or sexuality. And there was 0.27, that was anthropology and gender and sexuality. So just one out of like 350 or something. So funding is a big obstacle. Also because you don't have funding, you need to work on the outside to just live, which is harder for queer people to get good pay, to get to just get money. So there's this whole thing, and I think it's not about theory and academia, but we can't overlook it, because in order for people to investigate those fields of study, like the queer field of study and feminist, all of that, we need resources. We need to have the time to do it. So that's a very important point, I think. And then regarding theory, I heard a few things, always comments that it could be one that always that stuck with me is that I was told that it could be awkward for people to create a queer course, could take them off guard, could be like touchy, like a touchy subject. Are you sure you want to do this? And not even from people who don't want you to do it. It's not that. They do support you, but they're like, I don't know. It could be like, it could upset some people, and kind of like, my reality is going to upset people. Mm-hmm. So not only is my reality upsetting, but also the fact that I want to study it and produce knowledge about it. So But at first, I would say when you're in the early stages of your research, you have the energy to fight mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. as you go, you lose a little bit of it. So it's very tiring to always fight against a mountain, really. So, yeah, I hope that answers your question.
That's great. Let's say now, taking a look at the actual process of research, the going in the field, what is your experience? How have you been able to put into practice this idea that we're working against the grain? What are the considerations that you've had to take into account?
Well, the first thing when you go into research is that you have to do your, how do you say that in English? The form? Like, you know, you need to go in front of a committee?
The ethics review?
Yeah, the ethics. And you have to say what you're going to do, how you're going to talk to people. And so even before I went on the field, I had to ask myself, how am I going to just recruit people to participate?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with queer people is that it's self-determination. So I can't go around and ask people, would you come do my research with me because you look queer or because mm-hmm. I've heard, right? You can't mm-hmm. do that. So I usually just start with people I know, friends who, or family who, well, actually just friends because it's based in Montreal, but who already are engaged in this kind of process of thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And how it affects their lives and how norms and structures affect their lives. So I decided to do what I call the relational methodology, where it's kind of like a network where I start with people who just get the word around and people come to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that means there might not be a lot of people coming to you to talk about it, but that's okay. That means valuing what just one person will say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important in anthropology, but even more so in queer anthropology, that if someone tells you something about their lives and their experience, you don't need 15 other people to validate it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's good to have different experiences dialogue, but there's no point in comparing them. So I think queer anthropology on the field requires you to always value people and what they say, even if you don't understand it necessarily, because there's a million identities that I don't understand, even though I'm part of the community, right? So that's one aspect of it.
That's so interesting. So it sounds almost like it is also even inviting you to rethink what the standards of quote unquote like qualitative and quantitative analysis are. Like, it sounds like it's even inviting that. And the other thing that is super interesting is that I guess old school anthropology is all about like going and finding the people, and like you have this history, like stories of anthropologists like Clifford Geertz. Okay, old school, but still. Like, he literally like goes and inserts himself in the middle of where he's not wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like this is even going against the grain of that. Would you describe it maybe like that? Like, you're trying not to go where you're not wanted, but like you're trying to invite people without mm-hmm. forcing the encounter.
Well, there is still an immersive part. I for practical reason as well, I do my research in Montreal where I live. So I'm also always kind of collecting data. But I think in a way, if I understand correctly what you say, it's not about fixed locations or fixed communities that you need to insert yourself in anymore. Because people are more complex than just one situation or one community mm-hmm. or one experience. Like, say if I was working with drag queens or about the performance of drag, mm-hmm. it goes beyond just the cabaret or the bar, right? And I think mm-hmm. with Clifford Geertz, he would have been more like, let's go to this place, immerse yourself in it as much as you can, and try to thickly describe it, mm-hmm. detail everything. And when you're done, because you've described the environment that, with quotes, right, that people live in. But it's not just that, because queer people are so many things, in and out of different environments. So that kind of old anthropology, where there's this thing that you immerse yourself in and you describe it thickly as possible, to me, it's not relevant anymore. We need to trace, to map out people's life more than try to just get inserted in them.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. And how has that translated into work? Like, how has this translated into something that you're teaching now?
It's the first semester that I teach this. It's the first time it's taught. It's the first queer and feminist anthropology at the UDEM, at the Université de Montréal. So we're also experimenting in and going as, like, we're learning from it as very much. And I think what I could say is that it's been harder than I thought, because I'm trying to teach a research practice to people who are not engaged in this research practice yet.
Could you explain that?
So, well, it's like they're coming with a background that we all have, which mm-hmm. is 4 years, 4 or 5 years of traditional anthropology being taught. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to underline the fact that queer anthropology is about reversing norms. Mm-hmm. It's not about adding queer content. It's about mm-hmm. shifting the paradigm. Mm-hmm. Just like when feminist anthropology started, it was just about adding content about women. And then people are like, what is a woman? And it slowly drifted to, wait, this is not about content. It's about the form. Mm-hmm. We have to change the way we do anthropology and the way we perceive women. For queer anthropology, it's the same. It's not just, a part of it is, but it's not just about adding queer content. It's about queering research. And for instance, in archaeology, it would start with like getting rid of sex assumptions. When you find a body, a skeleton, the first thing you do is trying to decide, is it male or female? Mm-hmm. And queer archaeologists are like, maybe that's not the most important question. Mm-hmm. Because maybe this person, like, we don't know how they identified, so let's try to see what their life was, like, independently of their biological sex. Mm-hmm. But that takes changing the whole paradigm. So in class, we try to get them to change their paradigm, but it's hard. Even today, I had a student ask me about something they have to do. The question was, actually, they were a bit stressed because all they learned was to distance themselves from the subject of study. Mm-hmm. And we asked them to get involved in what they say, because you are not neutral as a researcher. Mm-hmm. But all they've learned so far has been to be neutral, to be more scientific. Mm-hmm. So it is difficult, and I think this year was very theoretical, and I think the coming years, we're going to have to do more like case studies, and how do you apply queer anthropology on the daily life.
Maybe taking it back a little bit to what you were saying about it being inherently political, How is that politics part of changing the paradigm, or how does it look concretely in terms of what you're trying to teach in the classroom? Like, one of the things seems to be that we try to take away the veil from that idea that we can be perfectly objective. So that's one of the things that you just mentioned. But how else does it look like a changing paradigm?
Well, I think it can be linked to what we talked about before and valuing one's experience.
Mm.
I think it's okay to be oriented, to have a point of view that is very situated.
Mm-hmm.
It's still relevant. It's relevant to a given context.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, yes, objectivity has to be, we need to get rid of this idea of objectivity, but also we need to stop to try to have absolute truth, to give an absolute definition to things. And queerness, or the word queer, lacks a definition.
Mm-hmm.
The whole point of this is to be not fully defined, or to leave some space for possibilities, for change, for like fluidity.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we produce a knowledge, a text that is fluid,
mm-hmm.
that is not fully defined? It's not just about getting rid of objectivity. It's about acknowledging the fact that it's relevant if it's unfinished, and if it's incoherent, and if it's contradictory. There's relevance in that. And it's the whole challenge. Like, how do you produce a knowledge that is understandable if it's fluid still, right? Because mm-hmm. in our society, we're used to consume fixed things to understand the world. But
you're part of this community, and you're not going with this making the strange familiar trope. Well, this doesn't sound like it.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that play? Because like obviously, there's this thing that even today we don't push as often, but like I know that in 200 level classes they will tell people that anthropology is understanding the self through a detour of the other. But here it's not quite the same thing, obviously. So how do you negotiate those quote unquote problems to knowledge?
Oh, it's an ongoing work, I would say that. But it's funny because when you say making the strange familiar, it's like familiar for whom?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like who are we homogenizing this whole thing for? And I'm more on the team of making, like, keeping the strange strange.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think in everything that we don't fully understand, like strangeness or anything that suspends meaning, there is a possibility for creating more knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So if we go into theory, my whole research about this is to find a way to conceptualize non-definition. Mm-hmm. And I worked on silence, not regarding queer anthropology, but regarding feminist anthropology, but it's linked. So I published this article. Actually, it was just officially published like yesterday or something.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. After 2 years of work on it. It's about how do we conceptualize silence as a form of suspension of meaning, and why do we need it, and do we need to conceptualize modes of suspension of meaning in today's science?
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's the key to always remake knowledge. So that's how I go about knowledge, but I'm still working on that.
It sounds very complicated, but I love how you put it, of keeping the strange strange. I love that.
Yeah, keeping the strange strange. But it's interesting because within the community, there are all kind of opinions, and there's a lot of people who would rather make the strange familiar and readable-ish for the rest of society to be more included, to like... And that's the whole question. Do we tame ourselves to be included in the rest of society, or do we keep on being subversive forever?
Yeah.
I don't think there's a middle ground. I think a middle ground would be, a compromise would be bad, because that would just take the good things from both things, take them away. I think we need to ping pong between different ideas rather than trying to have just one for everyone. But how do we build bridges instead of trying to homogenize people? That's the question.
Yeah, because homogenizing does seem to go against the grain of the very idea of queerness, right? Because, as you say, queerness is about not exception, but the possibility of something else, the possibility of not fitting the schemas. So that sounds quite interesting, quite a difficult question to answer. I think it does lead us back to that idea of... it reminds me of what you said at the beginning about someone telling you, you know what, this might be too sensitive for people. Like, how did that play out? How was that your experience in the classroom? How were people receptive to it? How did that turn out?
It turned out great. We actually had like a full house at the beginning of semester. We had to open more seats for people to register. Obviously, like, people dropped out because too much work, and we did have one student drop out because we were anti-science. Oh. That's what they said. And it was right after a biologist went on to speak about queer biology. But they were like, no, I don't agree with that. And it was kind of like, well, people who are teaching you that, they actually experienced it and they know it and they have PhDs about it. Like, just, but okay, we are anti-science. So that was the one backlash that was directed at, clearly we made that person uncomfortable about the idea they had about what is real and what is not. But other than that, it's been very well received, I think. I would say, I think it's a bit tame. Like, we have discussions and it's a little bit more like, it's very politically correct. Everyone agrees. And I expected, and I would have liked a little bit more of tension, not for the purpose of having tension, but for the creative purpose of that. But it's also, it might be because the way we're teaching it, because it's a bit too theoretical so far.
So you think that in a way the tensions are because the student population that gets attracted to these kinds of courses are already open to them, are already kind of looking for them. The course itself, it seems to be addressing some interest in students, right? Like, but at the same time, it's not attracting people who would be willing to, or not willing to, but who would be arguing against it, or because those conversations seem to be happening but elsewhere, right? Like, we have some famous professors in other universities who are very vocal against, who have very transphobic views, but like, it doesn't seem like those are the conversations that are being had in some classrooms. Like, I feel like it there's some separation of people according to their interests. So do you see that being challenged elsewhere? Like, what are the places where you think the practice of of the public, if you will, debate or conscious making or critique might be taking place if it's not in the classroom necessarily.
Mm-hmm. If I wanted it to be outside of the classroom?
Yeah, if it's not necessarily in the classroom, because at least the classroom is providing a space where people who are already interested in this are coming and you say are having sort of similar opinions, which is great. I mean, like, I think that we need a space also for sharing ideas that are similar. I'm just wondering where you think the similar ideas are finding each other. Like, where are the places where you see that knowledge contestation happening?
I think, weirdly, in other classes that are not about that subject directly.
Oh.
Like, I also teach urban anthropology, and it's a first cycle, like, bachelor class.
Mm-hmm.
And people who go to that are not necessarily interested in, well, it's not about gender and sexuality, so they don't go there for that.
Right.
And a lot of them are not even in human sciences. They study something else. They're in another program. But I always have 1 week I teach like anti-sexist cities. What happens with sexism in urban spaces? And another one is queer realities in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot also against racism and environmental racism as well, and how gentrification, like, it's all basically, they don't expect it, but it's all about race, gender, and like
mm-hmm.
queerness.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a lot of discussion.
Okay.
And even if though they agree that racism, sexism, and homophobia is bad, there is discussion and they share their experience a lot. So I would say it depends on the teacher as well. Like, and I've had a couple students in that class come see me and tell me it's good to have a queer professor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't hide it.
Mm-hmm.
And that I find is very interesting. Well, in feminist anthropology, they're also like very interesting, and they do share their experience. It's just, I guess it's another level of theory, and I wish it would have been a bit more theoretically engaged.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I also feel like at the bachelor degree level, there's more diversity as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also went to a college, like a cégep,
mm-hmm.
to talk about sexuality in urban spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a ride. But yeah, I don't know, to be honest, I don't know where else, because I feel like even in community groups, and there's always a norm, there's always something that dominates and can't really create anything. I don't know, I wish I could find those spaces. Do you have an idea where they are?
No, I mean, I think you really did give me that flashback of when I was an undergrad, and the class, to maybe bring it back a little bit to a previous discussion, is that it did make the familiar strange, you know?
Yeah.
Like, what I thought I had understood of the world and how it was structured, then
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden a professor has the chance of complicating it. And maybe
mm-hmm.
what you're saying is, in a way, that once it's complicating it, it's a refusal of letting it become homogenized again. So, like, to allow it to stay complicated, to allow it to stay strange. And
mm-hmm.
I think it would be wonderful if all 200 level introduction to anthropology classes would introduce a module that had to do with queer anthropology. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I think you're right in the sense that those are the places where people can be introduced to these ideas who might not have thought of them. And what about other forums? Maybe, like, have you encountered, maybe not community organizations, but other forums where you've been able to share these ideas or this practice, maybe in some other more politicized or obviously politicized spaces? Or what about even the AAAs? Like, how has that traveled?
For the AAA, I was talking about something else entirely, but we did talk about the importance of interstitial spaces and non-definition to propel other things. So we did talk about queerness a little bit, but it wasn't held in the States, and a lot of questions were about this US election. The panelists and I were like, why are we talking about this? But anyway, I was on a forum in the village in September to present an ethnography of the village that was done in 2020 by a company called Humain Humain. It's 350 pages long. It's online. It's really interesting. It says basically that there is a depolitization and a disengagement from people within the community, in the there's no collective political front anymore, and there's more and more fragmentation. But that's interesting. Anyway, so I was there, and it was a bit political, and there were people in the audience that asked us about inclusivity and how they said it did not mean anything and it was not enough, and even at this panel it was not inclusive enough. And that was really interesting, because it was a first step towards something, so you got to start somewhere, I guess. But at that panel, we did talk about should we be less sexual, so that way families will come to the village. And other people were like, no, our culture is sex. And I remember saying, well, lesbians, for instance, are the intersection of homosexuality and sexism. So for a lot of lesbians, and it's also said in the ethnographic report, it's not about sex. That's the thing. We want to be seen as not a sexual object, or sexual culture, the culture of sex. We're trying to get away from that in a way. Mm-hmm. And that's partly why the lesbians just deserted the village. So that's the thing. And there was a lot of homonormativity at that panel. And you want to keep the culture of sex, but it's just your culture and you're just one letter, if I can say it that way. So, I think, again, with the not trying to make everyone the same, let's just ping pong between all of us and value what everyone says. But that's hard. It's easier to say than do. I don't know. Ongoing work.
So, any closing remarks that you would like to do? This has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you so much for bearing with me and my COVID brain. But
thank you for asking those questions. I find it really rewarding to think about this. And it's easier to think about it with someone. I think my closing remark would be to summarize it, that we need new frames of recognition for queer anthropology. And one of those frames, and the one that I'm involved in, is non-definition and imperfection and strangeness, and how to keep this for what it is, or how it is used for people to redefine who they are constantly. And I think there is hope, but that cannot be done alone. I'm very happy that I have a co-teacher for the course, and you and other people who, even research participants, people are interested in this. We're not heard, but there's more and more people who talk about it. So one day we'll be heard fully, hopefully.
Hopefully one day there will be those modules in first year classes.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this week. This episode was produced by me, Daniel Chiu, music by Justin Kober, and cover art by Sophia Millian.
You can find a list of works cited in this episode in the show notes, as well as on our website, talkingculture.ca.
And from your favorite Talking Culture YouTube bro, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Come talk culture with us on Twitter at Talk Culture Podcast, Talk Culture Pod, or Instagram at Talk Culture Podcast, and hit that notification bell.
Anthropology is creating space for difference.